Hi, I'm Louise.
And I'm Mary Kay.
And together we are Novel Gazing, the podcast that talks all about literary fiction. We are recording today's show on March the 31st. Technically, it is the end of this endless month, so hurrah for that.
Right.
What has been this month? I just don't understand time anymore. So yeah, we have made it, everybody. Congratulations. On today's show, we're discussing current affairs and news from the literary fiction world, the books that changed our lives, and talking also about our current reads.
Yes. Before we get into the meat of the episode, though, we do want to hear from one of our lovely sponsors that makes all of this possible.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode.
And okay, let's talk about what's happening in the literary world, since, as you mentioned, like, we've lived through, like, March is a whole decade long,
isn't it?
And there's like no distinction of time. Yeah. So it just, when we look at things as new, I'm like, this happened like last year. It just feels like so long ago. There's been no change. We're all cooped up in the house going
I think
crazy.
I literally just spent like last week staring into the void. Just like thinking, okay, I'm gonna have to get my life back together at some point, but who knows where to begin.
Right. It's like the opposite of when the alien, like the members of the spaceship, Nostromo, go into space and they like get cryogenically frozen or whatever. It's like the opposite. It's like a fast aging
time period.
So what's new though?
Well, the weird thing is, and this is what really surprised me, is that there has been a big upsurge in sales for, you know, those big landmark titles that we're all supposed to have read but perhaps kind of haven't.
Right.
So books like War and Peace, The Lord of the Rings, In Search of Lost Time by Marcel Proust, they have all had massive sale rises. So as part of this, I had a look. I know, I was thinking, when was the last time that these big titles featured?
Right. And I feel like In Search of Lost Time is the tome to be reading right now, because what is time?
Yeah, we just all don't
isn't that one like seven volumes also?
It did specify in the article, which we will link to in the show notes, that it is the first installment.
Okay.
So maybe if this goes on for another million months, we'll all get to volume two or something.
Right. Oof. Okay. So what do you make of that?
I think it's really interesting. Because as I say, like I did a week of sort of staring into the void and thinking, I've got a PhD to write and things to do. And honestly, I have no inclination to do anything, let alone pick up a book or even read it. So hitting for these big bestsellers, well, they're not bestsellers, they're only just bestsellers. Hitting for these big landmark titles, has our genre's time finally come?
I hope so. Mm. And I also think that, I mean, I was, last week was kind of rough for me because I just was having a hard time distinguishing between times, if that makes sense. Like, what do I need to be doing? Plus, there's like an international crisis and we still have to, like, everybody, I don't know how this is happening, but on social media, everyone's like, no excuses for doing all the stuff you've been wanting to do for years. And it's like, well, yeah, that's a big excuse. Like, there's a crisis. Like, I'm a little preoccupied with that. So it is a little surprising to me that the books are being bought versus like you just taking them off a shelf being like, well, I've had Moby Dick forever. Yeah. I guess it's time to just tuck into that. But I think that's great because from what I've heard, a lot of online sales, especially through independent booksellers, is on the rise because everyone's on social media now and a whole bunch of independents are on there being like, hey, now's the time to, like, if you were thinking about buying a book before, go ahead and do it.
Yeah, please help us start a business.
Yes, or if you don't have anything in mind, if you are like Mary Kay, I'm talking about myself, if you are like me, then, and you're not ready to, like, buy more because you have a huge stack, like, buy a gift card and then use it later, just to help everybody with that. But it's interesting to me, too, that, like, the classics are the ones that are selling the most when I feel like they're the people, the authors who benefit the least from it. Like, they've been dead a long, long time. You know?
Yeah, but that is quite a potent argument, isn't it? It's like, we kind of turn to these dead guys to tell us how to deal with the massive crisis that we've got going on. And it's like, all right, I get that, because it's kind of going to your cultural touchstones, isn't it? And thinking, I can't answer the questions that I have to answer right now. So maybe this guy can.
Yeah. And I think also, while we're talking about like the nebulous nature of time, it feels very 19th century to me right now because no one who's alive now has lived through something like this where we're all like,
it is so strange,
staying
isn't it?
In
it's
your yeah life. It definitely feels like I should be watching Moulin Rouge and being like, I get it. You know, so it does kind of make sense that like we're a little bit not even nostalgic, but just kind of like referencing people who have lived through or did live really through something like this.
Yeah.
Because contemporary authors, while providing great escapism, which I thoroughly appreciate, we don't have a point of reference for this, really.
No.
Not personally.
I should hope.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, so. You're talking about like historians have a frame of reference for it, but not like a, you know, a personal one. That makes sense. I saw this really cool article about like Victorian parlor games. I was like, well, if you're tired of staring into your screen, like, you so we can link to that one as well.
One of the, because I collect a lot of books from sort of the 19th century, earliest 20th. One of the books that like, its time has come, is Victorian parlor games in the school and the common room and the gymnasium. And it's so hysterical because they're like, fold up a piece of paper, pass it to your friend. Oh, the hijinks that we had. It's like, guys.
Right, it's like, try to light this candle while standing on one foot.
Yeah. Oh, how we laughed.
It's silly, but it would be fun, you know, especially if you were making a drinking game out of it. Like,
oh yeah, well yeah, yeah. That's a good
everything
point.
Is a drinking game at this point, also.
Oh no,
But yeah.
What really interested me with this as well is that, like, I've said that I found it so difficult to concentrate on something. And mm-hmm. when I do concentrate on something, and I know this is going to lead into the article that you're going to talk about in a sec, I kind of want it to be kittens and rainbows
mm-hmm.
and kind of just quiet, soft edges and perhaps a slice of cake,
mm-hmm.
like that level of a book. So it sort of fascinates me that we're going for these big, almost scary, unanswerable books. But then I was thinking, well, maybe that's because we're living in scary, unanswerable times. And it's the
right.
whole, like, yeah, like we just don't want to be alone in dealing with it.
I think that could definitely be a possibility. And I think it also depends on how you deal with stress.
Yeah.
So, like, last week, and I'll tell y'all about this a little bit later as well, but I read Samantha Irby's new collection of essays called mm-hmm. Wow, No Thank You, because it does deal with heavy stuff, but she is so funny. Oh my gosh, she is. It is the kind of book that if you read it in public, which no one's going to do for a while, I know that, but like if you're
weird,
sitting...
Yeah, we don't read
right?
it in public.
Right, but if you're just... I mean, unless you're essential personnel, in which case, thank you very much for saving the world.
Yeah,
you
rock stars.
Anyway, it'll just make you, like, snort laugh into the abyss of whatever you're experiencing at the time. And it mm-hmm. is just a delight. It truly is amazing. And that the one that I just finished is Wow, No Thank You, which I think released this week. So go
you
get it.
On the ball with this reference.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, last week that was helpful for me is to like read something somewhat lighthearted or that at least approached really heavy topics in a lighthearted way. Like, let's make fun of the fact that I can't really control my bowel movements. Like, mm-hmm. it would not mm-hmm. be funny, you know, in if it was happening to me, but the way she's telling the story, it is funny.
Wow.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. I think maybe you're right that you do just need that moment to kind of go, let's just laugh in this
right.
in this situation.
Right, because, I mean, that kind of thing in the moment is mortifying. And then, like, as soon as I mention it after the fact, it is funny, you know? Like, it would... So that was helpful for me. And then my typical way of dealing with anxiety of any kind is to go deeper into the crevasse of like, okay. I need to know everything
yeah.
so that I can avoid it. And if listeners, if y'all read the most recent newsletter that I wrote for the Fright Stuff, all the books were about like contagion and quarantine because that's what's on everybody's mind. And it sometimes helps to look at like fictional representations of that. It sometimes helps. Now, like, you got to know yourself. Like, what we talked
yeah.
about, like last week, I was like, I can't deal with any more doom. I just, nope, it's not a good time for that for
just
me.
No, I'm done. It's over. Finish.
Right. And now I'm kind of easing back into it because that's my nature. But, you know yourself, know what you need. And I one of the articles that I linked to in this past newsletter, but that we haven't had a chance to talk about on this show uh-huh. is it's called, and it's from the New Yorker, but it's called What Our Contagion Fables Are Really About. And it lists a lot of famous ones like Jack London's, I think it's, I can't remember the title of it, but it's The Scarlet Fever. I'll link to it in the show notes so y'all know.
Sure.
Talk about Mask of the Red Death. They talk about Mary Shelley's The Last Man. So, and a lot of plague literature.
Yeah.
It's a very long article and pretty dense, as is the case with The New Yorker, and also fairly cynical, which is also the case with The New Yorker. So I'm gonna tell y'all what I took away from it. So if you're like, I don't feel like going real into that, this is the too long didn't read version.
Go for it.
I picked up the thesis and a couple of examples so that way I did your homework for you. You're welcome. I mean, I know you read it, Louise. I'm just talking about like colloquial you.
No, that's fine.
So basically the structures of the modern plague novel, there's two of them. It's either a story set within the walls of a quarantine, which is what most of us are experiencing right now, I think, or a story set among a ragged band of survivors, quote, within those two structures, though, the scope for the storytelling is vast, and so is the scope for moralism, historical argument, and philosophical reflection. And this is the part that I thought was the most important, which is also a quote from the author Jill Lepore, I think is how you say your last name. Uh-huh. Every plague novel is a parable. So it's going into the other literary, like by default, plague novels are literary is what this is essentially saying. She never came out and said that, but that's what I took away from it. And she also said that the final terror of every world-ending plague is the loss of knowledge. So I don't know what we're really supposed to do with that.
just deal with it in a calm and considered fashion.
Right. It was like, I don't know what it... I felt a lot of things about it, but it was hard for me to piece together the ultimate takeaway of that article.
It's a very dense piece. I think, for me, as much as I'm pro a mention of Mary Shelley, because I think, wow, what an amazing figure.
Truly.
For example. I think it was almost just like, here are books, here is a metaphor, which is perfectly fine at some level, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure what I can do with it at the moment. And I think that's sort of what I'm wanting. Like...
Yeah.
Doing articles.
Because I was like, okay, so what? Like, this was a great compilation of a whole bunch of plague stuff.
Yeah.
And what should I do with that? So I think...
That is actually like one of the best tips I've ever been given for like writing or research or something. Is if someone can look at a paragraph you've done and go, so what?
Right.
Like, what is the difference? What does it matter that I've read this? Like, what difference would it make if this paragraph didn't exist?
Mm-hmm.
If you can't distinguish a difference there, then there's a problem that you need to be looking at. And I think as much as I love the writing of this piece and as much as I love...
Oh, it's fantastic.
It's
yeah.
beautifully put together. I kind of lacked the everything's awful and it's a metaphor for something else equally awful. And I'm like,
yes, I think that was what we were supposed to take away from it. And I just don't think that's super productive right now. Like,
yeah.
Is that mean to say? Like, yeah. I think that that works for some people, but not me, I guess.
But more Mary Shelley references, everyone, please.
Oh, always, yes, for sure.
If you could send us those, we'd be very happy and feature you highly.
Yes.
Forever.
I agree. One more thing about this article that I took away, because the author of this article quotes Albert Camus, which is the most bummer of dudes. He is just the most bummer.
That's his new description. I'm sorry, that's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. she paraphrases him as saying, the enemy we have is other humans. And it's like, okay, literally, yes, we're supposed to stay away from each other physically.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't have knowledge without other humans. So, like, what is the deal then? Like, what is the... And I really thought when she was talking about Jack London, because Jack London is always like, yeah, I'm going to live this life. I'm going to smoke it to the filter. I really thought that it was going to come back around and be like, so you have to, when you're with your ragtag band of survivors, you got to stick together, which I also think is kind of what we're seeing now, at least in the art world. It's like, so while everyone who can do something is doing something, here's something beautiful we can share with each other for free.
Yeah.
Here's some exercise videos for free. And when you're able to pay it forward, we just trust in humankind that we will.
I saw something like that the other day in, I think it was Naples in Italy, where it was based on an old custom in the city now, where they were dangling baskets of goods from their windows. And it said, look.
How wonderful.
Gorgeous, right? And it was basically, if you can contribute to these, please leave something in the basket. And if you need something, please take it away and help yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's just that looking forward and finding other people and finding those points of connection that even though we might not have them practically at the moment, they are still there, and reaching for them is no bad thing.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And just to kind of like balance out that doom and gloom of the article that I suggested, I take full responsibility. I do. I'm glad that you shared that. And then that made me think of, so my neighbor and best friend, who I don't see right now because, you know, we're not supposed to see anyone. She's an intensive care nurse at Grady Hospital in Atlanta, which is where everyone goes during an emergency. So she videoed the other day at shift change, all of the people who live in the apartments came out on their balconies and applauded all of the workers leaving.
My goodness.
I know. And it was such, it was just like, that's what we all are doing, but I'm glad that they could see it or hear it, you know? So, yeah, I know it almost made me cry because it gave me so much hope.
Gosh. Yeah. All right. Yeah. If you're listening to this and you are a key worker and you are pulling us through and communities through this, then you have like all our respect for the entire world.
Oh my gosh, so much. Like you had it before, but now we're super like, thank you for saving our species again and again. So yeah, and if you, you know, if there's anything that us regular people can do, definitely let us know, because you know we're just sitting here contemplating our existence, so we'd love to be distracted from that.
If you would like kitten and rainbow references, let us know and we can provide them.
Yeah, so speaking of kitten and rainbow references, we're about to talk about our next section of the episode. But before that, we need to hear about our sponsors who make this possible, or a word from them. A word from our sponsors who make this possible. Okay, so now to introduce this next section, I would like to shout out one of our listeners anonymously, which is kind of defeating the purpose, but she wrote in and asked for our recommendations, and we really love when anyone writes in.
However,
we really do love the feedback. However, because we're not like a recommendations podcast, we had to kind of tell it slant. So like give you what you want, but also tell it through another lens. So we wanted to talk about books that changed our lives, which is to say, like, at some point while we were reading them, at least this was my qualifier, it made me kind of sit back and rethink something.
Yeah.
Like, rethink something that I was doing on a regular basis, or the way that I was living, or the way that I thought about something regularly. And because we had so many recommendations, we split this into two sections. So the first one is like, the first section, excuse me, is like books that we read or heard about during formative years. So like the, during school, like grade school or university, or, just at some point when it made an impression when we were, I don't want to say young, but like impressionable.
Yeah, that sort of period where you're being shown everything and taught everything.
Yeah, like when you're figuring out who you are.
Yeah, so those definitive moments there. And this was really interesting to me when we chatted about it, because I was thinking about the, as you might gather, I am from England. I am English. I don't know what is going to give it away to you right now, but the accent might be a factor. And the curriculum for me, my generation in school, was a really difficult thing in that it was a very static, white, masculine environment. And that's all sort of very well and good at one level, because you read certain books and you gain certain perspectives from them. But you gain a similarity, I think, right? You get this idea of literature being one thing. And I remember that the only author, the only woman of colour that we studied was Alice Walker and The Colour Purple. Mm-hmm. And she blew my mind. Like, absolutely. It was not that she, not just what she did, but how she did it, you know, embracing like the embracing the epistolary form, the idea of womanism, the idea of women living complicated lives and living them wholeheartedly and bodily and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And finding that was like having a light lit up in the darkness at some point, for sure. That whole discovery of something other than the life that I was living.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry that you didn't have a whole lot of diversity in your school, but if you're going to read one, Alice Walker is a good pick. Like,
oh,
she's amazing.
Cracking.
I didn't read The Color Purple until I was out of school, but we had Everyday Use in seventh grade, which I live in, or at the time, in rural Georgia, which I don't know what would give that away to our listeners. but I remember reading Everyday Use, which it's a short story, but in like seventh grade, and it's the family's two sisters who want to use antique quilts in different ways. So like one of them, which a quilt is like a huge deal. It's so labor intensive, especially yeah. before machines. And it's also the equivalent of a useful scrapbook. So you have like different, like when you wear out a dress, you save it for scraps to put in your quilt, and they have elaborate patterns, and it's just a beautiful form of folk art. And so one sister comes back from college, and she wants to take the quilt so she can display them. And the other sister, who lives at home with her mom, is promised the quilts so she can use them. And it's just like a really interesting way of appreciating history.
Yeah, that sort of tangible heritage, right, that you touch and
yeah.
feel.
And that was one, actually, I didn't put it on the list originally, but that was one that really made me be like, well, you're going to use it up. Or, I don't know. Like, it kind of made me sit back and be like, I don't know which one is right. So I really like Alice Walker, and I didn't mean to cut you off. I just got really excited. And
No. Alice Walker's a dream, isn't she? Like what she mm-hmm. does and how she puts it together. And like, it took a long time for me to realize that I was feminist, for example. But really
yeah.
about womanism and this notion that your femininity is so innately linked to your culture and your experience. It was like, wow, I love this.
Yeah. I love her.
Just pause to appreciate Alice Walker briefly.
Truly. It's also interesting to me that I know I've mentioned Zora Neale Hurston on past episodes as well. Alice Walker is one of the scholars and writers who kind of brought her back into
yeah.
the literary sphere from somewhat obscurity. And Toni Morrison, I could be getting this wrong, but Toni Morrison kind of was in like arm in arm with Alice Walker,
mm-hmm.
I believe, in doing that as well. Not as directly, but just kind of representing a similar minority, I think.
I love that. Like the whole, because again, this is something that really bothers me with the books that I read. There's a whole tendency to forget that literature existed past like the last 10-15 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Like that there were books before and writers before and authors before, and it's just that in some senses we don't quite know how to remember them and to think about them and how to understand them. And so authors that bring other authors back into the picture and reclaim them and shout out about them, I think it's brilliant to do that, to have that collective practice of knowing who you are and where you come from as a writer.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. And I know that like in popular culture, we tend to forget the old stuff,
yeah.
but I had a diametrically opposed upbringing where it was like, if it's good, it'll still be around in 10 years. So yeah. you should just wait and read stuff that is already good, which I don't think that's super healthy either. Like you need like a mix. Just to kind of bring us back to another book uh-huh. that I would like to recommend by Toni Morrison, who we all know is the GOAT. She is fantastic. I read Beloved, I think, my senior year of high school, and it taught me so much. Well, first of all, it's, I think, probably my truest first love of the horror genre, because even though Toni Morrison is definitely a literary writer, that book is horror. It is. Yeah. Like, the first line is talking about how a baby ghost is spiteful. And I just loved that unfurling for me of the firsthand sort of, it's fiction, of course, but a firsthand experience of making it to freedom as a slave, and then the fear of being brought back out of it.
Yeah.
Like, that was just so real for me reading this book. And we all abstractly, or maybe we don't all, but hopefully all of us abstractly know, like, that is one of the great human atrocities and abominations that has happened is slavery. But that fear of, like, making it and then being, like, sucked back into it. And I don't want to spoil too much of this book in case y'all for some reason haven't read it yet. But just, like, what you would do to prevent someone you loved from having to experience that was just really, like, it made history not make sense, but matter more to me personally. 'Cause it made sense logically, but not on an emotional level for me until I read this book. And then, as one of the followers that I have on Twitter mentioned lately, Toni Morrison's novel Paradise is widely slept on and also amazing. So I want to link to that one as well. We don't have to go into as much detail on that one because it wasn't like a formative experience for me, but I do remember reading it and being like, how did I not know about this one sooner? So, I really love that one.
There's those moments of discovery, isn't there, where you're like, how is this being kept quiet?
Yeah. I mean, I get that it was somewhat overshadowed, I think, by Beloved, because I'm pretty sure Paradise came out a few years afterward. But just, wow.
Yeah. It's a moment of silence for this.
Right.
Respect. All right. So, so hopefully we're starting to give you a bit of an idea of how these books hit us emotionally, not practically, because that would be awful, and has like visions of throwing books at people.
Metaphorically. That's not what they're for.
And the other one that I wanted to talk about, and I know this is super niche, and I'm going to sound really pretentious for a moment, so I do apologize.
This is a literary fiction podcast. You do it.
Yeah, we embrace this moment.
We do. We are elite.
At university, I went to a really avant-garde university, which is kind of like, we don't want to write essays. We want to plait poems out of strands of grass, which was the highlight of my life, essentially. And it taught me a ton of things, but it taught me that I was getting really interested in books that do things differently, that kind of realize that they're books, but sort of do something so innovative, so weird and different with the form. And one of the literature schools that this uni introduced me to was Oulipo, which is a group of French writers who essentially got together in the 60s, decided that literature is always a thing that's going to be written with constraints, right? So why not mess about with the notion of constraints and use those as a creative force rather than like a reductive force?
Ooh, cool.
Yeah, it's so, I love what they do so much. So they are Oulipo, and I'm just going to spell it out, O-U-L-I-P-O, and it stands for Ouvrier de Littérature Potentielle, which is appalling French. I do apologize again. Very English French, simply. But it's for opening the potential of literature. So, bit of a niche reference, but the famous, most famous one from there, again, this just blows my mind on a practical level, is a book called La Disparition, which is called A Void in English. And it's by a guy called Georges Perec. And it is a murder...
Yes, I've heard of this.
See? It's genius. It's a mystery about the absence of a vowel, the letter E. And the entire book is written without that vowel. So in this entire book, there is no word that uses the letter E. Which, wow. Yeah, every time I sort of say it, I think, oh my God, how did you do that without crying? He wrote it originally in French, and it is it's a really stylistic, brilliant, odd book. But the version that I read had been translated into English, and they kept the lipogrammatic constraint of the absence of the letter E. Wow. So it's got no E in French. So you think that nothing is masculine, for example, le. You can't use le, which is a fairly key thing. And in English, it's exactly the same. So there's no these, for example, or he or she. It's a stunning, stunning thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I can barely get my head around that kind of restraint. Yeah, one time in fourth grade, my teacher wanted us to be quiet, so she forbid us from using any words with the letter S. It was a genius punishment. Yeah. And this one kid would just keep talking, and then he would say cereal whenever he would get close to tricking up. That's
that
the closest
kid's a genius,
thing
I think.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So Oulipo, I think, was the first group of books that taught me that weird, innovative things were really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And that led me on to another book called The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, and that's from 1759, so it's a really modern recommendation for you. And it's by a guy called Lawrence Sterne, who was a religious, he was a curate, I think it is. He was a member of the church, essentially.
Okay.
And he decided to write kind of this strange autobiography of a fictional character. And it is the most bawdy, rude, funny, silly, abstract, weird, brilliant book. For example, when a character dies, he just has a black page in the book to indicate mourning. So the whole text just disappears, and there's just these big three, it's two black pages. So you turn over, the character remembers himself being born. He talks about the most beautiful person in the world, that you have to then draw into the book. It's so brilliantly odd that it kind of totally stretches and makes the book into something kind of magical and a bit mad and a bit strange and a bit dangerous. Mm-hmm. And that's so much fun.
It is so much fun. I love that concept of having the restraints but using them.
Yeah.
And one of the authors that I wanted to recommend does that somewhat, although less so in the book that I'm going to recommend, but somewhat, I guess, now that I'm thinking about it. Jonathan Safran Foer was one of my favorite authors when I was in college. He has a bunch of cool stuff, but the one that made the biggest impression on me was Everything is Illuminated.
Yeah.
Because I studied nonfiction in college or in grad school. So the fact that, I mean, this book is fiction. It's marketed as fiction, but he, the author, went to Ukraine to look up or to find out about his ancestors who had died in or survived the Holocaust. And he went and didn't really find anything that he wanted to talk about. So he made up a mythology, folktale, fairy tale about his family and their origins. I really loved first that he could do that, you know, like that.
Yeah.
That he was like, oh, you've obliterated my family's history. There was nothing left for me to find. It's not fair that they don't have a story. I'm going to make one for them.
Yeah. Look at my power that I have during this moment.
Yeah. And I loved that because, as happens when genocide is involved, you are deprived of your family's history. And that's not really fair. Or it's not fair at all, I should say. But I loved that book because
I get the style
of it is genius. It's like the translator from, I think it's Ukrainian. It's not, or it's a dialect of Russian that I don't really understand. But it's written in such a way that you can hear the accent because it's so obvious that he is very smart but doesn't understand all of the idiom of English, which is, I mean, impossible anyway, like we've talked about before. Yeah. English is impossible to learn because it's like three languages wearing a trench coat masquerading as one. But yeah, I loved that book because it's so cool this that he can stay in that voice for so long. And other works of his do that too. Other works of Jonathan Safran Foer's, like Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. And he did a one with like concrete poetry as well. That was very interesting. He does a lot of playing with the language as well, which I really appreciate. But more importantly, he tells a story that would have been lost otherwise. So
yeah.
And it is an invention. Like he says, it is marketed as fiction. He's still the title character, but you know, he's like, it's not fair that I don't like that all the records were destroyed so that I don't have anything to go on. And another book that I loved and shaped my life because of a similar sort of cultural pilgrimage theme or topic, I guess, is Roots by Alex Haley, because a similar thing, but to a greater magnitude, happened with African American people where they, you know, have no family history because slavery.
Yeah.
Slavery is the cause for so many problems even now. But they, it's all oral history. So he traces his oral history first. And then it's just, if you haven't read Roots, it is a big book, but we're all sequestered. So you have plenty of time to read it. And it's also, it's long, but it goes fast. So it's like, it's very accessible. There's no like stopping every five pages or every five words, I should say, to look up a word. Mm. You don't have to like make a character index like you do with the Russian novels where you have to like try to remember everyone, even though they never come back into the story, which I don't know why you would do that to your readers. Why are you mad at me?
Breathe. It's fine. It's fine. We'll get through this. It's fine.
Right. So, but Roots doesn't do that. It's made to be very accessible, or written to be very accessible.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And it's just such an important book that, if you haven't read it, you got to, like, it's a staple.
Let us know as well.
And it's interesting too, because, it does a similar thing as, Everything is Illuminated. But I think on a more wide scale, and it is nonfiction. But of course, like it's heavily researched, like documented and everything.
Yeah.
And also Alex Haley is like, he's amazing. He co-wrote the autobiography of Malcolm X. Like he's done so much good stuff that I don't know. I can't oversell it, I guess is what I was trying to say.
Read.
Yeah. And I think that some of those, or those two books particularly, like were important to me during formative years because I know y'all can't see me, but growing up ethnically ambiguous in the American South, I got asked on a regular basis, where are you from? And I would be like, oh, I'm from here. And they would be like, no, before that. And so it was nice to have like those family histories for me so that I could be like, oh, I'm not the only person who gets asked this. And doesn't really have an answer. I'm Lebanese, by the way, but like it's several generations back and a lot of it is lost to history. But I just, for me, it was important because it kind of gave me that culture. Like my family didn't get asked that because everybody knew them. It was a really small town when they were growing up.
Yeah.
So it was just like a community kind of for me that I really appreciated. And yeah, and even if you haven't experienced that firsthand, you might want to read it so that
you know how it is,
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, Louise, do you want to start us off with more recent life-changing recommendations?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, I do.
Yay.
It's handy, isn't it? If I just said no, we could just stop. But no, I'm here for the books.
We're done here. I'm just kidding. I want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah. So the more recent life changes, because we're thinking like education is that really big moment of where you are kind of given a lot of things to read. But then equally, there's the moments where you go out and you start to find the world for yourself, the literature world for the literary world for yourself, the idea of other books existing, like the shift from reading what you're told to reading what you want to read is quite a marked thing.
Yes.
It is.
It's
so difficult.
Awesome.
It is. It's great. But I remember like I used to work in a university, and the shift in that first year is a lot for people to handle, where they have to go from led learning to self-led, and it's a massive, massive thing. So for me, it was kind of just slowly tracing the paths of other women writers and these communities of thinkers and communities of ideas. So one of the big discoveries for me was the publishing house Virago, which is a feminist London publishing house. It's so great. I recommend them entirely to you in so many ways. But one of the ones that I really enjoyed was recently, and was quite like it was so landmark for me that I even started writing down on the pages. And I thought, oh, gosh, I don't do that normally.
I know you don't.
I know. Wow. I was like quietly hyperventilating to myself, going, "What are you doing?
I'm doing it.
Yeah, I know. Talking myself away from the pen and page. But I was like, but you have to. This is so beautiful. Was a book called She Came to Stay by Simone de Beauvoir, who I have mentioned before. But in its original title, it was known as Longue Vitae. And it's a novel about a woman who becomes involved in a relationship. So there is basically three people in this relationship together, and things get very complicated very quickly. And
oh yeah, I cannot imagine.
Yeah, it's,
I really cannot,
so
around it. It's
messy and yet so honest and so raw and so beautiful and so terrifying in a way, because Simone de Beauvoir really has this great gift of going straight to the emotional heart of something, even if it's not necessarily a pretty place to be.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Longue Vitae blew my mind quite substantially, and you should be able to get it secondhand fairly cheap. Do, if you can, and give yourself time to read it, because it's very dense again, and there's so much going on, but it's really worth the effort. So Virago was a massive one for me, but then more recently, the two big books that have blown my mind were Duck's Newburyport by Lucy Ellman, which is by, it is a small British press called Galley Press, and it's an immense book. It's like five times the size of everything else on the shelf, because if you haven't heard of it, it is written primarily in unbroken sentences. So it just goes through and through and through. And the refrain that repeats is the fact that. So it's like a narrative of her inner thoughts and her soliloquy of life. So the narrator just goes, oh, the fact that so-and-so hasn't done his washing, the fact that I need to make this pie, the fact that blah, 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 and it goes on. And the rhythms of this story and her life are blindingly good. And it ties again with the other stories that I've mentioned, in that it takes the book and it makes it something brand new.
Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about like the sentence structure,
uh-huh,
it reminded me of, and this could be wrong, but one of the feminist texts that I learned that does that similarly, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, please do, is Girl by Jamaica Kincaid.
I do not know that one, no.
It's a short, I guess you'd call it a prose poem. I studied it as poetry, but it's essentially like a series of warnings spoken to a young girl. But it's like tasks and also like the, what is it called? It's a phrase that gets repeated like as a refrain where it's like, yeah. It's the something you are so bent on becoming, which is like a bad thing. It's not, I think it's a, like a curse word, so I can't say it here.
Okay.
But it's very good. It's just like, it's a very short piece. And I remember what you were saying, like I read it and I was like, oh wow, this is so important.
Yeah.
But the fact that they sustained it for a full, or that she sustained it for a full book length work is,
it's impressive. Remarkable. Like the effort that this book must have been. I think it took something like 7 or 8 years to write, in that it was so intense. And yet each page is almost poetic in scale. She finds these rhythms and these beats. And it does. I think you're right in mentioning the Jamaica Kincaid thing. It reaches very much back to these texts of womanhood, identity, speaking, these oral stories of like figuring out how it is to be who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. I like those types of texts that kind of make you if not change, at least assess why you are the way that you choose to be.
Yeah, that, like, give you that mirror. That
choice. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it can, I mean, I think that's what we're saying here is, like, if it doesn't make you change, it at least makes you double down on what you've been doing.
Yeah, for sure. It gives, like, you that more, moment of understanding. Yeah.
Right. So I think I'll go into, wait, did you hit all three of yours?
Yeah, the other one that I wanted to mention was Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo.
Yes, I remember you mentioning this.
Oh, my days. Yeah, I will mention it at every opportunity that I can. Okay. I'm really sorry.
I'm like that with Beloved.
Yeah.
No, I'm not sorry.
It's like, if you gather anything else from these podcasts, read Beloved and read Girl, Woman, Other. Because it's just, it's brilliant. It's such a confident, brilliant, kind, sympathetic, odd, brilliant, fun, fabulously written book. And again, it's all these stories about identity and who you are, and as you say, offering you the opportunity to reflect on your choices and your decisions. And we don't sort of often mention this, or we haven't really yet, but it is beautifully produced. Like the jacket and the design of it, it's a really good looking book. And it's
that's just always a bonus.
Yeah, I think sometimes it gets forgotten sometimes that, you know, we can go for like the literary fiction cliche of some meaningful squiggle and maybe a fancy font and leave it at that. But yeah, Girl, Woman, Other is just a treat from like start to finish. And Bernardine Evaristo is an author that you should be heading towards with all your might if you can. Because she's just a gift. She's so incredibly talented.
Subtext, add to cart.
Tick.
Yeah. So, I'm trying to figure out where to start here. I guess I'll start where I've already been, about Samantha Irby. It is a little less overtly literary than I think most of our recommendations have been. And most of our texts that we talk about on this podcast are.
Yeah.
But, and she says, like, she's just making jokes, but of course you're going to say that, right? Like, so I mentioned when we started the Wow, No Thank You, her newest collection of essays that just got released. But I've also taught my English 1101 composition class about a selection from her previous essay collection called We Are Never Meeting in Real Life.
Yeah.
And it opens with a story called My Bachelorette Application, where she just eviscerates the pop culture of reality television. And it is the funniest and most apt hilarious. Like, it's just, it's everything. And my students all were like, she's so nasty. And it's amazing because this is exactly what you think while you're watching it. So it's, I definitely recommend that book of hers as well. And the ones that, the books that changed my life, quote unquote, changed my life, later are usually, they have something to do with form or perspective. So I'm reading them more as a writer, if that makes sense. Like, yeah. Oh, this is something I've never seen before, like on the page, kind of like what you're saying about the, refrain and the long sentences, or, not including the letter E.
Yeah, gosh.
Which is, it's still unfathomable to me. Like, I don't. No.
Welcome to my world.
Anyway,
I'm
distracting myself. So one that I read for fun, right, when I was self-learning, is by Timothy Schaeffert, which I think is how you say his last name. As I just said it aloud, realized I have never heard it aloud before. It could be French or sounding. I don't know. But it's called The Mermaid in the Tree. It's a retelling of the Little Mermaid fairy tale from the perspective of the woman that the prince does marry.
Yeah.
So she hates the mermaid. And it's, which is, I love a fairy tale retold from the perspective of a villain, pretty much always. But particularly if they're feminist and the more magical / gritty the telling is, the more I enjoy it. And I don't know how he does it. It's just so wonderful to me. It's like if the Coen brothers and what's the guy who did the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus got together and wrote a book. It's like both noir and fantasy somehow. It's just fantastic. And it's a short story. It's included in the anthology, My Mother, She Killed Me, My Father, He Ate Me, which is fairy tale retellings.
Yeah.
But if you're like, I'm not really into short stories or anthologies, his book, The Swan Gondola, has a very similar, tone and setting and characterization, including like mute ventriloquists and crash landed hot air balloons and vaudeville performances and poison and ghosts. And it's just, oh my gosh, it was so hard for me, but I just idolized him so much that I asked him to write a blurb for my book that's coming out next month when you're listening to this. And he was like, sure. And I my spirit left my body, did a victory lap around my apartment complex when it was safe to go outside, and then came back into me. And I was like, this is, I can't believe that, first of all, you even read it, that you responded, and that you said, yeah, it was just amazing. Anyway.
Did you do one of those traditional sort of calm emails at the end of going, oh, that's really great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm so glad you agreed to. Thanks, man.
So happy for this car.
Cool. I'm fine.
Press send.
I'm totally fine.
Screaming. Yeah.
I'm not crying. You're crying, probably. So I really love his writing. And then I think I've mentioned this collection of short stories before, Her Body and Other Parties by Carmen Maria Machado. She's also the creepiest. I want to be her friend so bad. Like, she's just the coolest. And her story, Inventory, which is about a similar plague-related apocalyptic scenario, is amazing. And I don't want to give away too much of it, because the form of it is kind of the joke that you realize at the end. And it's also the title. So like, you should know it from the beginning, but you don't.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. It's a list of sexual experiences, but it's so much more than that. And this is what I told my English composition 1102 students. Like, if you think it's just pornography, I'll know you didn't finish reading, because it's not. It's so good. And she also retold the story of the girl with the green ribbon at the beginning of the book. So it's like several It's a collection, like I think I said. But that was one of my favorite urban legends when I was a kid. You know this story, Louise?
I do not. I was gonna say, is this, what is this? Is
it something? So it's I can tell it to you real quick.
Okay.
It's an urban legend / folktale about a girl who wears a green ribbon around her neck. And she falls in love and gets married. And then when she gets really sick and she's about to die, her husband asks her, I've always wondered why you wore a green ribbon around your neck. And then she pulls the ribbon off and her head falls off. Yeah. So it's one of my favorites, and I didn't spoil it for you. I told you the whole narrative, but her story has so much more going on in it, in her body and other parties. So those are my more recent life changers. And I'm sure as soon as we sign off, I'll think of 1,000 more.
Yeah, that's the way,
because that
it,
is though, the nature of my mind. But yeah, and I'm so glad to our listener who wrote in and asked us to do this, because this was
a
really
so
fun
much.
And I think longish episode for us. But yeah.
Yeah, I think it's fun. Like, I think
super
it's
fun to talk about what you love.
Yeah, reflecting on those moments, and you think, wow, they are like the pivot points in my literary life, and seeing where they took you and what that was. So yeah, thank you so much for that idea.
Yeah, it was a great idea. If y'all have other ideas, listeners, we want to hear them.
Yeah, let us know for sure. All right, so to wind up this episode today, we will let you know about our current read. So Mary Kay, what are you reading at the moment?
So I just started reading The Brief History of the Dead by Kevin Brockmeyer. It is also a plague apocalypse. I'm just
running on a
leaning into it at this point, right? But it's very interesting because, and I'm again not spoiling anything because it says it in the epigraph. Have you seen the movie Coco, the animated movie?
No.
Okay, well, just kind of to give the backstory.
But I know of it. Yeah.
Okay. So when someone dies, you go to like a next life, and you're kept sort of alive, living dead is what they call it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
That you're kept alive by the memories of people who remember you. And then it gets weird because the city starts emptying out. So the spirits who are kept alive starts just like there's no one there.
Oh, okay.
That's as far as I've gotten. I just started it, but I heard it was really good. So yeah,
and
I'm liking it a lot.
Is it working for you so far?
I think so. Excellent. So far, yeah. What are you reading?
Well, all right. So I was tooking into a book called Unflattening by Nick Souzanis. And it's a really interesting book. He wrote a comic for his PhD thesis, essentially.
So
rather than submitting like several hundred pages of text, he submitted a comic. And it's all about visual theory, how images work, philosophy, and everything in between. And this is the collected published edition of it. So I'm not been able to look at the thesis itself and see, you know, like what the specific differences are. Mm-hmm. But the published collected version is so interesting. It's really a literary non-fiction book. And this isn't something we've touched on so far. And we will do probably in a further episode, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah. Talk more about like literary nonfiction and how that works, some picks for that. But
ooh,
this
yeah.
is so interesting because it's all about images and counterpoint and how visual literacy works and where to go with that and how to fold narrative and play around with it and see what comes out at the end.
Ooh.
So yeah, it's so interesting. I don't think it's one to read all at once, like read a chapter in fair isolation, which ironically we all are in now.
Right.
Yeah, I know, it's a perfect read for now.
I love that title too.
Yeah, it's so good. If you like things like, you know, Scott McCloud and his comic book theory work, if you enjoy big graphic novels that ask complicated big questions, I think this is going to be one for you for sure.
Awesome.
All right.
Well, I think that wraps up everything that I wanted to say.
Me too, yeah.
Are you good too? Okay. Then in that case, we're going to sign off. A big thank you to our sponsors. Thank y'all for listening.
Thank you.
Don't forget to subscribe through however you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell your friends and maybe your mom about us over the phone safely.
Mm-hmm. We are pro moms.
Yeah. Where can they find you online?
You can find me at my website, which is didyoeverstoptothink.com. And I am on Twitter at chaletfam.
Wonderful. And this is Mary Kay McBrayer. My website is marykmcbrayer.com, but you can also follow me on Twitter at mkmcbrayer and Instagram at Mary Kay McBrayer. That's just a whole bunch of my own name dropping. But yeah. That's it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thanks so much, y'all. Talk
Cheers,
to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.